Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
I think I might kick off then, actually.
Okay, we're going to start now. Welcome to this session, which is entitled Is AI the End of Art? This is part of a whole series of discussions about AI that are taking place throughout this weekend. My name is Sandy Starr. I am Deputy Director of the Progress Educational Trust, which is a charity that works in the fields of fertility, genomics, and embryo and stem cell research. And I'm also the author of a recent pamphlet about AI. We've already been exploring many different aspects of AI in earlier sessions this afternoon in this room. And now we're going to ask what the latest advances in AI mean for art, entertainment, and creativity. At a time when generative AI enables increasingly intricate creations, sounds, images, including moving images, programming code, to be summoned in seconds via prompts in plain everyday language, are artists and entertainers becoming surplus to requirements? Or do we need them more than ever? And if we do need them, how are they to earn a living? How are they to receive due recognition for their work? We have an excellent panel of speakers to help us answer these questions. Their experience and their expertise spans a number of different endeavours and art forms, and I'll introduce them briefly in the order in which they're going to speak. But I encourage you to look at their full biographies on the Battle of Ideas website to find out about their many accomplishments. First, we're going to hear from Dr. J.J. Charlesworth. J.J. is an editor at the magazine Art Review, and he's author of the book Criticism, Art and Theory in 1970s Britain. And if I understand the scope of your book correctly, J.J., that means you're not just an art critic, you're an art critic critic.
Yeah,
which means he's well-placed to guide us through the Hall of Mirrors, that is AI. Then we will hear from Vivek Hurria. Vivek is a composer whose works in recent years have been performed by musicians from the London Symphony Orchestra, the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group, and the Piatti Quartet, among others. And alongside his musical endeavours, he's also an accountant, which means he's probably the only artist in the whole of the UK who does not dread doing his tax returns. Then we have Rosie Kay. Rosie is an acclaimed dancer and choreographer. She is chief executive and artistic director of the dance company K2 Co. And she's also co-founder of the organisation Freedom in the Arts. They have a stall in the main assembly hall here, which I recommend you go to. One might think instinctively that dance, by its nature, is an art form that's very resistant to encroachment by AI, but there are those who think otherwise, so I'm sure we'll be discussing that. And then finally, we have Dr. Hamish Todd. Hamish has degrees in philosophy, computer science, molecular biology, mathematics. Doesn't it make you sick? So it's an understatement to say he sees AI from several different perspectives. He's been a video game programmer. He's created educational resources that defy easy categorization. And I can say with authority that his enthusiasm for maths is infectious, because at this festival a few years ago, he infected me with it, and I've never been the same since. So they're going to speak for 5 to 7 minutes each, and then after that, I will invite questions and comments from you. So if you could please start us off, JJ.
Thank you, Sandy. I think, obviously, it's great fun to be on this panel because there's been so much visual art involved in the AI hype of the last year or two. There's so many images you're probably familiar with. Everybody is conversant with Stable Diffusion and DALL-E and all these other large language model platforms which are being rolled out and are being given to the public to play with. Obviously, the principles underlying them are bigger than just producing images, and they have consequences for human beings and human creatives, or artists, or people who are involved in the creative industries. And so in one way or another, they do have a serious bearing on understanding what is going to happen to the culture of the commercial and public arts, as it were, whether that's film, TV, video, painting, music, dance, and so on. But I think that given the level of hysteria of the last few 6 months in terms of these things being rolled out and everybody's starting to go, wow, what is this thing? What is it doing? How does it do it? And also then the increasingly sort of panicked and shrill, and I think certainly from some of the panels commenting on them earlier today, ridiculous political and commentary, political commentary and policy commentary and debate around AI. I think it is important to kind of pull in what these things really are going to do in terms of the fact that they are tools and not intelligence. I think it's a really important point that's been made earlier today that the idea of artificial intelligence is very much part of a marketing hype. We should be very cautious of that, without at the same time denying that they will have an effect on what people do, on how certain things, knowledge, culture, so on, is produced. So I mean, I think just to kind of go through from the most banal level to the more important issues, I'm going to start with, first of all, jobs, because there's a lot of people I've noticed panicking about this is going to destroy our jobs. We are going to be made redundant. And then go through, I think, quickly to more profound questions about creativity and art making, which I think are relevant and often under-discussed. I think the first point to make is, yes, I'm very sorry, some of you will lose your jobs, right? The arts are not a secure employment sector. It is very likely that people who are employed in certain creative arts professions, when I talk about the visual arts, I'm going to be very broad and talk about commercial arts, graphic visual arts, design, advertising, typography, whatever, a whole range of things that people have to use creative discipline and creative talent to produce. I think a lot of people are worried that AI will come in and alter their relationship to their product, their employment product, the thing that they produce to make a living. And I think that a lot of those fears are well-founded, right? You can't not see, use, say, for example, Adobe Photoshop and the fact that, that Adobe is implementing AI functionality into photographic manipulation, not to realize that, essentially, this is going to make certain kind of laborious functions that are in the disciplines of the creative industries more simple to do, right? So less labor will be expended doing certain things, like graphic design, like photography, like stock photography design, development, and so on. There's many aspects of what people do as jobs in the creative arts which will be simplified and streamlined by the implementation of AI platforms, and it is already happening and it will have a consequence. I think it's important also, however, to realize that this has always been the case whenever technology has innovated and the creative arts have had a dependency or relationship or creative and productive relationship with technology and tools, right? So, when Paul Delaroche in, I think it was 1839, when he saw a French painter, a French realist painter, saw the first photograph, he said, "Oh my God," he said, "from today, painting is dead." Of course, well, It hasn't been dead. It wasn't dead. It went off and did different things. But it's important to recognise that there is an anxiety about the fact that when technology changes, people's talents and productive value changes. This is a thing as old as going back to the Luddite rebellions, when people started sabotaging mechanical looms. Now, but at the same time as that's going to happen, it's also then the case that those platforms will make things easier to do and make people in the creative disciplines, commercial creative arts, more productive. And so I think it's important, first of all, to kind of acknowledge that jobs will be lost, other jobs hopefully will be made. And the fact is it's not going to be AI's fault. It's just the fact that principally creative artists in the commercial creative arts work in a sector which is very precarious in terms of employment, right? Badly paid and insecure. And that's always been the case and will continue to be so. I think what I'm much more interested in terms of the development of AI in the visual arts, in terms of theoretical and philosophical principles about the question of art and creativity, is that actually it reveals, and it's been very interesting to see the rollout of the large language models when it comes to producing visual works, right? Digital images, animation, fake photography, simulated photography, and so on. Paintings, things that look like paintings of dragons and whatnot. I don't know if everybody's kind of caught up with Spiral Town, that viral meme of a town landscape which also has a sort of hidden spiral within it. That's been doing the rounds. This is an AI generate. What's really interesting about the discussion about AI image generation is that it actually shows that human culture by and large, or human visual art culture, is very uncreative, right? Now, I don't want to sound like I'm having a go at artists, right? Because I'm not some haughty critic who's dissing creative practitioners. But the interesting thing is that it reminds us or reveals to us in a new way that actually most of the time, creative artistic discipline is repetitive and rote. It requires, large cultural communities of makers, artists, and audiences are used to the fact that actually artworks, whatever they are, tend to be similar, right? So if you didn't have this principle in human culture, that the fact is that most things are not original, but most things are iterations of creative insights that have been once established and then are taken forward by many other people. If you didn't have that, there would be no such thing as style, for example, in painting. There would be no such thing as genre, okay? Genre and style and historical periods in art of whatever type are expressions of the fact that people originate things and then other people pick up what they've originated and don't copy them or reproduce them, but take them off into what perhaps technologists would call or mathematicians would call iterations, right? So that's been very interesting in terms of the explosion of AI, interest in AI image making, because we know the debate, and of course the debate around copyright rests on the fact that these large language models are based are only productive because they know, not in an intelligent sense, but they know a lot about all the other images that human beings have ever produced that happen to be on the internet. Right? So they have a huge corpus in the language coming up. So they have a huge corpus which they draw off, and they are able to produce things which are very sophisticated, but are essentially repetitions of genres and styles and forms that humans have already produced. Right? I think that's to kind of set the terms for my kind of curiosity in this. The fact is that if we have a situation where people's original production, creative artistic production, the visual arts, is simply kind of reprocessed by AI, but nothing new goes in, what we are already seeing is that AI generates a genre and a style of its own, which is entirely dependent on what human artists, photographers, painters, and so on, illustrators, graphic designers, have already produced and formed the base of the corpus. Now, what I worry about, and this is the end of art bit for me, is, well, what happens when we stop originating to feed the machine, right? What happens to our culture when we partly give up the sense that really what's important is making new things and become more passive to the idea that what we're enjoying is simply iterations of a very large corpus, admittedly, but one which actually is becoming increasingly static and inert culturally. So those are the questions that I think are really important because they're quite ambivalent currently, and they have a lot to do with understanding our role as both a public, that is a kind of active public that might have opinions about art, right, and also our role as artists whose responsibility and definition is to think reflectively and critically about the things that already exist. Because that's the one thing, if we are talking about a debate about the distinction between machines and humans, that's the point at which I think we want the discussion when it comes to art and AI.
Thank you, Vic. I will add a small technical clarification. The image-generating AIs, possibly the musical ones as well, I don't know, they're not just using large language models. They're also using another type of what they call foundation models called diffusion models.
Yes, diffusion models. Yes.
It's all part of the same thing. Yeah. Explained in this handy pamphlet. Over to you, Vivek.
Thank you, Sandy. So I asked ChatGPT this very question, is AI the end of art? And I received the following response. AI is not the end of art. It's a new chapter in its evolution. While AI can generate stunning pieces of art, it doesn't replace the human creativity, emotion, and intent behind every brushstroke or musical note. Instead, it opens up new frontiers, allowing artists to collaborate with machines, explore uncharted territories, and push the boundaries of what's really possible. Art and AI can coexist, each enriching the other in this exciting era of technological innovation. Now, that was very beautifully put, but is this really the case? So before I dive in, I'd like to clarify a couple of terms. When we talk about AI, we're referring to the broader field of computer science that aims to create machines or software capable of performing tasks that typically require the intelligence of a human. And within AI, there's the subset known as generative AI, which has seen this real boom in the last year. And this specific area focuses on creating systems that generate content that appears to be created by a human. So think text, images, music, anything creative, really. ChatGPT is one example, but there are plenty of others out there on the market now. Bard, DALL-E, Midjourney, Stable Diffusion. In the world of music specifically, Ava, the artificial intelligence virtual artist, recently became the first AI in the world to officially receive the status of composer and became registered under France and Luxembourg's Authors' Rights Society. But let's take a step back for a minute and recognize that controversy over new technologies within art and within music is really nothing that new. From the mechanical organs of the 16th century to player pianos, each innovation has initially faced some sort of resistance. Even the advent of the MIDI player in 1983 stirred up some concerns. But fundamentally, these technologies didn't replace musicians. They became a new medium for exploration. Great composers and songwriters like Bach, the Beatles, Mozart, Queen, David Bowie, etc., they weren't confined to the norms of their time. They innovated. They introduced new ideas to music. They pushed the boundaries of what's really possible. And so AI's been around for a while now, and there are nuances with which composers and experimental musicians have been approaching this technology, and it's led to a wide array of different approaches emerging. Some argue that AI poses a threat to the creativity of human musicians, but as JJ's already said, it's crucial to view AI as nothing more than a tool, a collaborator, an assistant, rather than acting as a replacement. AI has the power to augment and enhance our musical experiences. It's not about humans versus machines. It's about humans and machines working together. So I'd now like to briefly talk about the work of a colleague of mine, Robert Laidlaw. He's a contemporary composer delving into the intersection of generative AI and classical music, specifically using the symphony orchestra as his canvas. Rather than seeing AI as a threat to creativity, Rob is embracing computer-generated sounds to explore music in lots of novel and intriguing ways. His composition Silicon, written recently for the BBC Philharmonic, perfectly exemplifies this approach. Firstly, his piece redefines what AI technology means. He turns it into a tool to empower the human musicians. The musicians directly interact with the technology that is designed to replicate their sound, and it creates this really nice symbiotic relationship. It transforms the orchestra into what Robert calls a contemporary laboratory by challenging traditional perceptions. There's even an AI-powered instrument, the second movement, which is played by the orchestral pianist, and it really pushes the boundaries of what traditional orchestration means. In the final movement, there's an AI which is trained on the BBC Radio Concert Archives and creates orchestral sounds completely independently. This phantom AI orchestra coexists with the human onstage orchestra and blurs the lines between what music and sound is, what's human and what's machine. It's a really cool piece, and I'd encourage everyone to go away and have a listen. And Rob's work is just one example of the many innovative possibilities which AI is already bringing to the world of music. In 2019, Huawei taught its smartphone to compose the unfinished movements to Schubert's symphony. This collaboration between AI and composer Lucas Cantor showcased the potential of technology in the musical creation process. But remember, the point of these projects wasn't to finish the symphony in the way that the composers would have, but rather to demonstrate the power and the capability of this technology. In my own creative practice, I've started to use ChatGPT when setting text for songs, and even the composition software I use, Sibelius, has an AI-assisted chord autocomplete function. Fundamentally, though, this raises the question of the relationship between the composer, the musician, and the AI, which I think needs to be explicitly defined or even redefined. So it'd be naive of me not to talk about the issues and the potential limitations that, and even the risks that this technology might pose. Amidst the innovation, AI poses a challenge and potentially an existential one to the world of art and more specifically to the world of music. The fear isn't that computers will replace human work, but rather that music will become irrelevant in the age of AI. Questions of authorship and authenticity arise. Who is the true author of a piece of music suddenly when this AI is involved? But this brings us to an even broader question, I think, which is how should we delineate the boundary between creator and creation in this orchestration of art and artificial intelligence? And why is it that the big tech companies are suddenly exploiting this technology? And who's really benefiting from it and who's being harmed? Hopefully these are all questions we can delve into deeper during the remainder of the discussion. But for now, I'd like to leave you with some words written by Beethoven. What you are by accident of birth. What I am by myself. There are and will be 1,000 princes. There is only one Beethoven. In a world where technology is taking on more and more roles, human composition and human performance remain intrinsically precious. And so I guess ChatGPT wasn't entirely wrong. AI isn't the end of art. It's a tool, perhaps even a catalyst, in an ever-evolving future of human creativity. Thank you.
Rosie.
Thank you very much for inviting me to be part of this battle of ideas. Excuse my husky voice. At first, I thought to myself, why have they asked me? My job is the body. I'm a choreographer. I live in the harsh reality of gravity, body parts, sweat, technique, injury, and live performance. I work with live people in a studio, often for very long hours, creating something out of nothing. My job as a dancer and a choreographer is ridiculously and utterly embodied. We cannot dance without reality, and reality dances for others in their minds, because we dance with our minds, our bodies, and our souls. Or do I? I will come back to that. Firstly, let me start with two, quote, kind of stories. The first was by Stephen Bartlett, the guy who does the podcast Diary of a CEO, discussing creativity, AI, and algorithms with former Google AI exec Mustafa Suleiman. Stephen gives his definition of creativity, explaining that it's just taking a few things that he knows and combining them in a new way and interesting ways. Basically, they agree human ingenuity is algorithmic. describing a way in which he, Bartlett, could create AI imagery. He says, "You could say, I want to see Elon Musk in 1944 New York driving a cab of the time, shot with a Polaroid, expressing various emotions, and you'll get this perfect image of Elon sat in New York in 1944, taken on a Polaroid." That's done what an artist has done. It's taken a bunch of references that artists would have in their mind and combined them together, and this creates quote-unquote art. Contrast that with Studio Ghibli artist, in my opinion, Japanese animation genius Miyazaki. In an online clip from several years ago, he's shown by a new animation workshop an AI-generated monster-looking creature which is dragging itself across the floor. Artificial intelligence could present us grotesque movements that we humans can't imagine, the AI presenter explains to Miyazaki. Miyazaki looks disgusted and then takes a moment to compose himself. He states, "Every morning, not in recent days, I see my friend who has a disability. It's so hard for him to just do a high five. His arm with stiff muscle can't reach out to my hand. Now, thinking of him, I can't watch this stuff and find it interesting. Whoever creates this stuff has no idea what pain is." An awkward silence gathers in the room before Miyazaki drills the point home even further. "I'm utterly disgusted," he says. "If you really want to make creepy stuff, you go ahead and you do it. But I would never wish to incorporate this technology into my work at all. I strongly feel that this is an insult to life itself." So to research today, I watched as much AI dance as I could stomach. And like ChatGPT to a literary agent or algorithmic art to an artist, Elon Musk in New York, anyone, it made me think that AI is only as good as what you put in. It takes an expert eye to see how little comes out. Art is certainly not just grabbing a few things and put them together in a new way. This is a mindset that thinks on a very superficial level. What is produced is a simulacrum. What is produced is artificial indeed. Making art is not only the product, but also the process. It is the process of human ingenuity, the bright spark of individual work, often over tens of thousands of hours, that helps you reach a decision in an instant that reshapes the reality we are living in. Allowing AI to reshape our reality will only result in further simulacrum. The process of making art is like painting an ancient Russian icon. It is the slow layers built up, often over a long period of time, with each new colour adding a symbolic meaning, an alchemy of thought, process, and intention weaving together. However, back to my dance studio, a place I have loved unconditionally, but recently have found to become a very hostile and at times intimidating environment. People, the medium of my work, are hard to work with, particularly in a culture of grievance and complaints and microaggressions, such as asking people to turn up on time. Back in the early 2000s, I was lucky enough to work with US choreographer Merce Cunningham, and I would watch him at the side of the dance studio as bodies sweated and strived, absorbed deeply in his own choreographic computer app that he had invented called Dance Forms. Dance Forms allowed Cunningham to visualize on-screen sequences and phrases, which he would then translate onto a dancer's body. Still a young and incredibly enthusiastic dancer, I wondered why he would prefer to do this work on a computer than work with a real, live, breathing dancer like me. Recently, I learned that his first company walked out on him entirely following his first successful European tour. His name was made, his cast deserted him. Now I think about he needed that distance between the person, the choreographer, the body, and his intentions. He wanted to experiment alone. He wanted to visualize exactly what he saw first in his mind and then give that to the dancer to work on. I started to see the attraction of working with non-human entities. To conclude, if the workspace, in the arts particularly, continues to be the most horrific and hostile environment, if they keep shepherding us towards online entertainment and making real-life entertainment difficult, painful, and awkward, and if theatres stop being brave and putting on interesting and creative new work, maybe AI is the future of the arts. And then the real thing, the live performance, the physical experience, that will become the domain of the super elite who can afford to see it and can afford to pay for the training of those who can do it. The rest of us will have to do with a dodgy headset in our living rooms. Thank you.
Hamish, cheer us up.
I've got some predictions. I'd like us all to cast our minds forward 30 years. All right? There's some teenagers in the room, I think, and in 30 years' time, you'll be in the middle of your career. So this is 2050, and I think we should take it for granted that in 2050, people are still making art a lot, because people like making art. So it's one of the things they like doing, whatever. And I also think we should take it for granted that artists will use a lot of AI. Everyone will use a lot of AI. So art continues in some form, but here's an important question. Of the art and entertainment that people choose to spend their time with in 2050, choose to spend their time appreciating and consuming, how much of it will be created entirely by an AI? Whereby entirely, I mean not even without prompting from a professional. Probably most of you are aware AIs, like Stable Diffusion, tend to need prompting. If there's somebody who's paid to prompt the AI, in a manner of speaking, that person is an artist. If it's only prompted by a user, that's not so much an artist necessarily. And then if it's obviously has no prompt at all, but it makes art, there's no human in the loop at all. All right. Here, I'll say my predictions and I'll try to give an argument for why I think them. I think that the performing arts will be safe. I think that dancing, acting, and music performance, there'll be as many jobs or more in that industry in 2050 as there are right now. Perhaps more. On top of that, thinking about music composition and painting, the kind of thing you see in an art gallery, there will still be some humans. There'll be celebrities, all right? The kind of people who can fill a gallery, right? And that sounds like I've covered a lot of artists there, but there is actually another kind of artist, okay? The other kind of artist is the kind who does advertising gigs and writes soap operas and draws children's comics or teaches music. They're not famous, but they're able to make a living for themselves and their family. And if you look at arts graduates, more of them are this than are the celebrity artists. And I'm afraid to say I think that industry is probably going to be obliterated. Like, maybe a small part of it will still exist in 2050, but I'm not optimistic for them. If you are a filmmaker and you want to get some music added to your film or your advert, you'll have two options. You'll either say, let's just get the software to do it, which will do it instantly and cheaply. Or you'll say, we've got loads of money here, actually. Let's get Hans Zimmer, or let's get Lin-Manuel Miranda, one of the people who's enough of a celebrity that there are people who will come to see the movie just because they like this name. It's like being a footballer, essentially. Either you are at the top, you're getting lots of money, you're a celebrity. If you're not a top footballer, you're just a really good footballer, you've got nothing. All right. The reason that I have this expectation, which of course could be wrong, by the way, like I'm maybe 70 or 80% sure of what I just said. But the reason I have this expectation comes down to biology. Humans are not the only species of animal that likes art. And I think we do ourselves a disservice if we focus too much on humans when we think about art. There are many whale species that sing. There are hundreds of bird species that dance. There's a kind of fish that makes sand sculptures 100 times larger than itself. There are dolphins that cultivate skill with blowing bubble rings, which they then do spectacular acrobatics with. Humpback whales and blue manakin birds are even known to have fashions and cultures in their songs and dances. Why do animals do this? Why do we like singing and dancing and all of that? Why do we do it? You might say we do it because the other fishes and dolphins and whales and so on like seeing us do it. But that just kicks the can down the road. You've got to ask, why do we like listening to the things? Modern psychology points to the conclusion that animals, including humans, evolved a sense of aesthetic pleasure and appreciation of other people's art because it helps us establish and navigate hierarchies of our social groups. For humans, you can think of this as being related to the concept of celebrity. All right? Celebrities are individuals who are widely known and are gossiped about and are respected, at least by somebody. Humans and arguably blue manakin birds can gain celebrity by producing very aesthetically impressive things, right? And if you're a non-celebrity human, this is key, if you're a non-celebrity human, it benefits you to appear to be allied with a widely liked celebrity when that celebrity comes up in gossip. Intellectuals like to pretend that we don't gossip. That's just for non-intellectuals. But intellectuals gossip just like everybody else. They just do it in a slightly different way. Let me give you an example of why I think this is relevant to AI. Think about Usain Bolt, fastest man in the world, though he could be a bit faster if he was in a car. He can get faster if he uses a machine, but we aren't impressed by him for his use of a machine. We're impressed by him using his skill, using his body to go fast. His skill is both very rare and very coveted. That makes him a celebrity. It's not exactly the speed. It's the fact that he is a person. And we like people who are really good at things. We like celebrities. Scientists follow scientific discoveries for the same reason, by the way. I'm not just trying to poop on artists. All right. This is why I think for the foreseeable future, following art will be about following people. Humans can't really bring ourselves to care about what AIs have done. If you do become a person who's just enthusiastic about what AIs have done, people will just say, oh, well, you're a loser. You're like those people who like Warhammer or something like this. Your taste is serving you poorly, sorry, yes. And they'll be correct in some sense because you can reproduce with a human. You can't reproduce with an AI. Not for the next century or so. And so for the time being, it makes sense for humans to concern ourselves with the abilities of other humans and to gossip about humans and to regularly update our aesthetic tastes so that we are especially impressed by what celebrity humans do rather than what the AIs are doing. Thank you.
Four very different perspectives. And a useful reminder, I think, from Hamish, that if we want to understand the difference between humans and machines, such as it is, it's helpful to understand the difference between humans and animals, such as it is. And on that note, I will, if we have a roving mic, I'll take questions and comments, starting at the back and moving forward. Sorry to make you go all the way to the back. But yes, right there. Please, go ahead.
Thanks for the great speeches. I went into a bookshop recently, and it's a depressing experience nowadays, but the thing that struck me is that one of the things that occupy all the shelves are little books that come with a selection of paints or of pencils or things, and they're painting by numbers books, right? And you'll see on the train or on airports or whatever, people everywhere are doing these little painting by numbers things. And they're very, very sophisticated now because they give you all the right tools and all the right colours and tell you exactly how to do it. And in the end of it, you produce something, if you're kind of attentive and careful enough, that looks vaguely like a decent painting. And you sit there and you're like, oh, look at what I've done. And people show them to each other and you feel, it's like a sense of achievement. You've done something that broadly resembles art. And I was thinking about this because I think that lots of our discussion about AI and art comes at the discussion kind of from the wrong way, thinking about, well, are artists going to use AI to make interesting art that people will appreciate? And actually, I think lots of the kind of contemporary focus on it and why the various apps and Stable Diffusion and things like that have really taken off is not because people, they're designed for kind of public consumption, but they're designed to mimic the thing that people have very little experience of in the modern world, which is of creation. And so people spend an afternoon doing something, punching in some prompts, and they get at the end of it, like the painting from Numbers result, they get something that broadly looks like a piece of art. And look what I did, look what I made. And I think that, and it's completely phony, of course, but the point is, why are people drawn to it? And I don't think we're yet at the stage where you can really say there's a kind of public demand for AI-generated art, and we're talking about that. Rather, what's driving this is that people have no experience of creation, of doing things, of the sweat, blood, and tears that comes with creation. And what people get instead is this simulation, this simulacra, this version, this kind of phony version of the experience of creation. And I think we should do a lot better to think about why are people so starved of the experience of creation rather than why kind of or what AI might achieve with art.
Brilliant. Can we move forward? Yes, please. Yep.
Yeah, no, I'm...
Can you stand up, please?
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah, I have a few questions. I guess maybe I should only have one. I'm just going to start by saying, like, Hamash is what he said, the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life.
I do not believe that people only get value out of art because there are other influential
people who also like it. I mean, maybe that definitely is true. Like, obviously, the concept of taste exists, but a lot of the object of fascination, I mean, people make stuff, people make art that only they even ever see. Yeah. I know there are people who use Adobe Photoshop to, like, edit the tiniest pixel on a photo because they think that's important, or they want to perfect something. I guess my second question, which is for JJ, which is about how do you think this is going to affect the discourse around, like, the creative industries? Because when the creative industries concept was originally created, the whole idea was, oh, we're going to be part of the new economy, we're going to be part of the knowledge economy, so we're going to hook ourselves to, as it turns out, like, at the time, like, the dot-com bubble. And, like, I guess question is, like, is this AI art kind of going to be, do you think this is going to be, like, endorsed by the creative industries just to essentially be in with that new group? Or do you think that the arts are going to use some other marketing opportunity to put themselves at, like, kind of the foreground of the agenda, the government and so on?
Thanks. Can I hop over the aisle, please, to this gentleman, and then I'll go over there.
Yeah, I often kind of split, or I think of splitting art up into kind of two buckets. There's the kind of, there's the vision, there's the intention, that the meaning that you're trying to make, and then there's the execution, there's the skill, there's the craft, if you like, of realizing that. And I just wonder what people thought about, you know, there's definitely lots of inroads being made into that second bucket around skill, technique, execution. Do you think AI can make any inroads into the first bucket?
Great. And I'll take one more. Oh, if you pass it, yep, over there. Great.
I'm a writer, and I spend part of my time writing novels, and part writing everything from corporate communications to ghostwritten wedding speeches. I'm not that worried about AI writing novels, not because I don't think it can, but because I don't make any money from novels anyway. For you, robots. The other stuff I do make a living doing, and some of it does look perilously like something a robot could do. But funnily enough, I've written a series of blogs for an HR company on whether AI will cost people jobs. So either it didn't occur to that company to think, why don't we just get AI to do this? Or they did that and weren't satisfied with what they got. And you know, doing the speech stuff, I often get stuff, someone will send me something, I put my stuff into ChatGTP, and here's what it said, now help, because it's garbage. It just doesn't have. So, I mean, the higher end of what I do, I mean, the low end is kind of basically search engine optimized blogs and junk, and I'm sure that AI can do that, and it's fine, I will survive without it. The higher end is a bit more like consultancy, where you talk to someone who's not exactly sure what they want. They can't do the prompt, So I have to talk to them and then think about that and come up with the prompt. Now, am I deluding myself to say that gives me an edge over AI? Is it only a matter of time before it gets there? Or is there still something in that kind of the human element of what do you call it, a creative spark, or just having that subjective human level eye to eye kind of understanding of what someone wants?
Can I ask you something? Do you bill yourself as a prompt engineer?
I will now.
Okay, I'll let the panel come back and then I'll go back out to you. A lot of different things on the table, and including whether people are currently starved of the experience of creating things, as that phrase might have once, that term might have once been understood. Discourse around the creative industries, the inroads that AI can make are idea versus execution, loss of livelihood, and I would make an observation as well, which is that when we think about prompts and generative AI, people usually default to thinking about positively weighted prompts. In other words, you're asking the technology, come up with something that best matches the words I have given you. You can flip that on its head. You can ask the technology to give you something that worst matches what you have given it. And from that kind of approach, someone's created a piece of art called Loab, who is the algorithmic inverse of Marlon Brando. And it's a very interesting little experiment. So I just put that out there, different ways of using prompts than perhaps we tend to talk about. But respond to anything you like. Shall I start with you, Vivek?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think to the first question at the very back about the paintings by numbers, I think like nowadays we're seeing sort of this sense of instant gratification. So if we can sort of create a piece of art and feel that sense of achievement, well, why can't we sort of play around with basic generative AI tools and get that instant buzz? But I think there's no experience of that lived experience. There's no, as you were saying, there's blood, sweat, and tears, the process, the actual qualia. And that's sort of what kind of makes the machine so distinct from the human and the humanity. To the question about the vision and intention versus execution and craft, again, I think it's only, the AI is only going to spit out, what it creates is only as good as what you put in. So I think the vision is going to be dependent on the prompt engineering. I don't think the AI as a tool can actually have, again, that lived experience of having that intent, having sort of a forecast of what the final product might look like. And also just as a point, how we talk about this technology, intelligence, hallucinations. We're using language and terminology which kind of anthropomorphizes it. And that's quite dangerous, I think. I don't know whether the other panelists agree with me. But those would be my two points.
Shall I start with you, Rosie?
All right. Also to the first point, I think that's kind of a really interesting point about the colour by numbers, and it seems like that's to do with sort of well-being and calming, mental escape. And I sort of worry that actually what we're... there's a wider question about society that we're kind of selling mental illness and then art becomes the cure. And that's also like very much prevalent in the dance world, where there's sort of an instrumentalism that goes on about kind of art, dance for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or falls, and that's kind of missing its point and purpose for me. In terms of like the vision meaning, I might come back to, but the execution skill and craft, actually we're in really danger of losing some of this. So the art schools, the conservatoires, are going through quite a radical decolonization sort of process. I've told this story before, that when I've asked a dancer to pull up their knee and point their toe, I was sort of eye-rolled. Something like ballet is a very pedagogic body-to-body, teacher-to-teacher, very much about the individual's body mastering a very certain historical dance skill. And it would only take a couple of generations for those skills to be lost, possibly forever. So I'm kind of very concerned around that area of skill and craft and holding on to that in order to then fulfill the vision, not just for its own sake. And I think there's a little bigger question here that's going on and it's rumbling around and everywhere that I don't think we've really had to articulate and really justify the purpose of art, possibly since the Second World War, and we're not very articulate at doing that. And that art is there not to serve entertainment purposes, it is there to explore the height and depths of humanity. And often that needs to come, in fact, always I think it has to come, through a very individual approach. And that is the individual that has that human vision and then has to hold that vision collaboratively and take it all the way to its fulfillment. And this idea of everything being done by consensus eliminates that individual truth and it becomes propaganda.
Okay. Hamish, do you want to grab the mic?
Right. Okay, I'd like to paint a picture of what I expect a lot of art creation will be like in the future, because I think that...
Didn't you do that already?
No, well, I wasn't super specific as I want to be with some of the things people are talking about. So you've got prompting, right? This is important, and if you never heard of the prompt before, again, you can prompt Stable Diffusion. The example we had was, what is it, Elon Musk, Polaroid, 1944, et cetera, and it gives you that. That's a bit straightforward. A more interesting one might be prompting an AI like Midjourney with dragon catches princess as she falls through the air or something like that. I don't know. You can prompt these things with anything in theory. You get something in return. It might be good. It might be rubbish. I think about one of my favorite film directors, right? A person like that is mostly talking to other people. That's how they do their art. They're in charge of a large team. Some team members are doing this. Some team members are doing that. And when the director, you presume that there's a person in charge, when the director says, I want you to do this, I want you to do that, they interpret the director's orders and get on with it. They bring their own creativity into it, of course. If they do something that the director really doesn't like, the director says, no, I didn't want that. Do this thing, change this part of it. And that's what a lot of prompt engineering is. So I imagine that the directors, the film directors that I like today, they're a lot like prompt engineer. Sorry, there's this term prompt engineer, which is somebody who really cultivates skill with prompting AIs. And that could be, that's a special new thing that's never, so far as I can tell, existed before. It also treats the AIs as, in the words of JJ, I think, tools. The director, when they're in charge of a team of people, in some sense, treats them as tools. You hope that they're also respecting their individuality, although I think some, like Alfred Hitchcock was he was very nasty to some of the people that he worked with. You can be as nasty as you like to an AI, of course. Yes, cultivating skill with these prompts is quite a lot like what artists have done for a very long time. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, and I'll bring you in, JJ, then go back out. I would say that the statement, you can be as nasty as you like to an AI, is controversial.
Oh, really?
Is it good for you to be nasty to an AI? Mm. Never mind the AI, is it good for you?
Yeah.
I'd hold that thought. Right, yeah, JJ.
Okay, there's... I mean, I profoundly disagree with Hamish on celebrity and... and also dolphins. I think it's a very cynical and very hollow view of what happens. It's a very kind of psychobiological or behaviorist version of what happens when individuals, human individuals... deliberate what it is that they are making and experiencing, right? There is an entire history of Enlightenment aesthetics which deals with the problem of what it is that we're doing when we're enjoying or not enjoying art. We keep talking about what is good, you know, whether we can get the AI to make something good. We don't ask ourselves, where does the idea of something being good come from? Is it an objective criteria or is it subjective? That's the basic point about all of the history of human aesthetics is I'm not sure whether this is good because I just like it, right? Or because there's something that takes it beyond my pure preference. Now, I think there's a very important point to make about the relationship between the viewer or the experiencer, the public of art, and the maker, because we share community, right? Brendan Behan, who came up with the playwright who came up with that dreadful, very mean thing to say about critics, right? He said art critics are like eunuchs at an orgy. They know how to do it. They can see how to do it, but they can't do it, or something like that. But it's cynical. It's a mean one. It's very funny. But it kind of points to the fact that although I can't make art as well as someone else, I can talk about it because being an audience, being a human being that looks to art and experiences it, is a community that encompasses the maker. And that is valid. Now, the people's desires, tastes, impressions, likes, dislikes become the substance of being a cultural community. We can argue over what it is that makes something good rather than something I just like. Now, I would reassert that kind of traditional post-Kantian aesthetic tradition, because I think it's important, because aesthetics is never just about me feeling, it's about what we think about feeling together. This is a complex point about the tradition, you know, the history of aesthetics. But I wouldn't dump on Bob Ross, by the way. Okay, lots of people want to make paintings. It's to Jacob, you know, people who do paint by numbers. People want to be participant in the making of cultural of artworks because there is some value to them. People like landscapes. And they like it when they've painted a new landscape that is theirs. And it's a part of a community of landscapes that they can all deliberate over. I think the important point about AI, and this is coming to Hamish's prognostications about 2050, is that I don't want to live in a world where my pleasure is entirely moderated by machines. Right? So artworks which are produced solely by machines in order to please me, right? I think is possibly the most passive and dismal prospect for a cultural community. That's to say, if you know, we're already in the age where machines feedback loop on our responses to see what they can get out of us, right? Of course, it's not the machines that know that they're doing this, but the machines are set up to do this by people who run Facebook, Google, social media platforms and whatnot, right? We talk about the algorithm and how the algorithm is there to kind of provoke us and to polarize us and all this kind of stuff. So, but the reality is that it's quite possible to think of a exploitative cultural, commercial society in which AI is entirely harnessed to producing stuff that we like without us ever being participant in the critical discourse or debate about what the artwork is good for. That's an entirely pacifying and pacified and commodified relationship to art making, which is, of course, a longer and bigger debate than just the AI one, but which AI is tacking on to just right now.
Okay, great. We have a real debate here, and let's get more contributions from the floor. Can we start halfway back, please, with the gentleman purplish shirt? Brilliant. And then I'll get as many of you in as I can.
Cheers, thanks. I want to suggest that we look at AI as a medium, not just as a technology. And if we look at AI as a medium, not just as a technology, JJ mentioned photography and its relationship to painting. Some of you might be familiar with Marshall McLuhan. He makes the point that new media enter the world quite uncomfortably. They don't quite know what to do with themselves. Film first begins by filming theater performances, and it seems quite wooden. It does another thing, though, which is spectacle. So the Lumiere brothers take a camera and get a steam locomotive to run over it, and nobody has ever seen this before. And it takes somebody else, an artist, Dziga Vertov, to combine the two into Man with a Movie Camera that some of you might be familiar with, and to show what the new medium might be capable of, for example, close-ups, for example, a moving view, rather than the static theatrical view that film had done before. AI is a new medium. New media have only ever added to art. We're not quite sure where the new media will take us, but new medium have only, I would argue, ever added to art, ultimately. And the question I would argue is, if we think of AI as media, then we might ask, well, how will we use this new media to make meaning? Because this is what art does. Art is more than is more than entertainment. It's more than singing and dancing, as much fun as that is. And I'd suggest that meaning is about relationships. Meaning is about creating meaning, is about adding to a conversation, adding something to a conversation that hasn't been said before. When an artist or an author or somebody, doesn't have to be somebody with a fancy name, when somebody can do something that adds something to a conversation, that's new and that's interesting. And that's not the kind of repetition that we get with commercialized celebrity consumer culture, which incidentally is more recent than the tradition of art. My point is that I think it takes courage to make that new meaning, and whether we call them artists or not, that kind of activity will continue to be a profound aesthetic activity that humans undertake. And what will that look like? I don't know. We'll find out.
Okay. Who's nearest to you with their hand up? Just pass it to them. I'm going to do this algorithmically, as it were. And if you could please stand.
There was an article in the New York Times, the magazine, the week before last, by a guy, I think his name was Jason Farrago, and he's a cultural critic. What he argued was that during the whole of the 21st century, there has been no progress in the arts. That although you can point to individual great films, or, you know, he actually used, I think, contemporary art when you're in a gallery, that there's been nothing in the 21st century that we haven't already seen. And I just wondered, is to pick up on your point about reiterations, if this AI is just going to like increase that stasis, or if possibly it's going to give us some kind of, you know, way out of it.
Yeah? Okay. If you hop over the aisle. Yep.
Thank you. Fascinating discussion. I work in East London, very close to the new 3D super high-tech ABBA auditorium. And as I saw it kind of taking shape a couple of years about not knowing what it was, like this amazing space bubble, and then I saw the words ABBA, I thought, this is the end of music, the end of culture. We've got them forever. Then it's going to be Elvis, and then on and on and on. And then I kind of thought, well, hang on. And then I kind of started thinking a little bit like what you were saying about how, you know, mediums and what if, you know, you did original work? What if, you know, artists and choreographers even took this, you know, amazing technology and did something completely new with it? It's not beyond the realms of possibility. So maybe it's just, you know, trying to have a kind of optimistic take on things.
Can you pass it straight in front, and then I'll move over here. Yep.
Yeah, there's been my mind is spinning around on a lot of things on this. I'm not quite as sanguine about the speed that AI is going to change. I think it's going to evolve very fast. And I think that the nature of its structures are going to change quite dramatically. I can imagine, you know, that thing that you read, the little ChatGPT thing, I thought that was incredibly sinister and very, it made my skin crawl, really. But I mean, I think about, you know, ChatGPT and these software programs that are available right now, they're nothing. And I'm quite sure that there's AI stuff out there that we're not being shown, you know, that's being, you know, maintained by security agencies and government and that sort of thing, where there are levels of sophistication that are already out there. So my question, everybody's talking about, oh, it's a tool, it's a new media, blah, blah, and everybody's very happy and pleased with that. But that's all based on the idea that human beings still are required to be involved in it in some way, and also that it's feeding off of existing human input in the stored internet base, as you described it. But I don't think that's going to last for long. I really don't. I think what's going to happen is that for instance, if I was thinking about trying to build that algorithm, I would be thinking, if I wanted to generate, unprompted, a brand new piece of art that's good, I'd be feeding in art criticism for the past 50 years, taking into account the society and the structures that were taking place at the time that the original work was created, and how that criticism changed over time, and then giving the AI that built-in thing to now come up with a new, something that is really brand new that nobody's ever seen before. And that's what the threat is. And I question, who is the art for? If people aren't paying for it, then if I'm an artist, I do it for myself. I mean, I assume that that's why most artists do it. They hope to earn a living out of it. But most true artists do it because they've just got to do it for themselves. Mm. AI won't stop that.
Okay. Can we pass the microphone over? Just, yes, to the row behind. I have seen you. I'll come to you in the next round.
Yes. I wanted to pick up Rosie's really important point about what is the purpose of art. And I think here it comes to Hamish's provocative idea of art as a celebrity. And I think that is a key problem, because the art is about the art, not the artist, in the sense that the best artists are concerned about exploring the human condition. You know, the point about the Kantian point about the starry heavens above and the moral law within, and what Rosie was talking about in terms of that exploration of art is both about beauty but about mortality and pain that she was speaking about. The idea of art being this celebrity, that's a view of art that is utilitarian. And that's why you have dancers not wanting to be disciplined to the art, because they're not understanding themselves as servants of the art. You know, it's a post-romantic view of art that what matters is the personality of the artist, as opposed to what they were doing. And actually, the Romantics themselves had a real sensitivity to what is limited about AI and algorithmic art, which is about adaptation. In Samuel Coleridge's terms, that is about fancy. Whereas we've got a different concept in terms of what is human art, and that is the imagination. But unfortunately, we have a culture, you know, anthropology has long talked about human language and creativity as merely being about adaptation. It's not. We are of nature, but seek to transcend nature, as was explained. And finally, you know, the point about Bach, you know, Bach was a composer's composer. He was playing around with the new technology of his day, but he sought to create sublime art as a servant of a community. And I think that's all the things that we need to be thinking about. But thank you.
Okay, I will come back out to the audience in a minute. Yes, it's so interesting, isn't it, Rosie? The example you gave of Miyazaki, and it made me think of, you know, Nick Cave, when they said to him, here's your ChatGPT generated Nick Cave song. And he got furious and said, you know, ChatGPT hasn't suffered. It hasn't had its heart broken. It hasn't done this, done that, done the other. So there's all of that to pick up on. Although there's another bit of my mind that's thinking, well, we've had art that was algorithmic and strange and used chants. We've had Brian Gysin and William Burroughs doing cut-ups and fold-ins and doing all crazy sorts of crazy things where they kind of removed things from immediate human agency and warmth.
Cunningham did that.
Yep, Ernest Cunningham. So perhaps I'll just let you pick up on however you like, Rosie, and then move on to Hamish, who's also been implicated here.
I really like the point about it being the AI as the medium, and I like that I'm going to come away from that, holding on to that, as a little bit more optimistic. What else was I thinking about? Oh my goodness, ABBA. I think that speaks of the whole relationship that the people that are sort of the gatekeepers and the controllers of art and artistic products and entertainment have around the attitude to risk. And we're becoming incredibly risk-averse society when it comes to art. And I'm not going to go into all the reasons why that is, but it is really, like, personally affecting lots of us in the arts world, even just proposing the concept of something that may possibly have some risk. It's now written into the Arts Council National Portfolio Organisation guidelines that if your organisation, and any artist that works for your organisation or the artists within your organisations brings you or your organisation into any reputational risk, or could be through social media, the Arts Council can freeze or withdraw their funding. So this is now written into the new guidelines. So that whole thing about ABBA, yes, there's been, I know some of the choreographers involved in that, but, you know, isn't that brilliant? You can just make it and it's the same thing every night. Nobody gets ill, nobody gets injured, nobody gets angry and goes on a crazy rant. You know, it's just dead. It's dead. Then to go to, like, I like this whole thing around, like, that sort of postmodernism, post-romanticism and all the rest of it. My question is, can AI dream?
Yes. That was the name of the neural network, wasn't it? Deep Dream.
Yeah. Yes, it hallucinates.
But does it?
Yeah, that's a very sort of contentious term.
Right, all right.
We've talked about it. It does, though, doesn't it? Okay. Anyway, okay. So I'll start with, it's not my idea, by the way. It's mainstream animal behavior. Thank you very much. So I'm a huge fan of Immanuel Kant as well, and Enlightenment aesthetics generally. But I think that the discovery of evolution tells us a lot that we're still not really absorbed yet as a society. Immanuel Kant, he would have been an amazing evolutionary biologist. So the golden rule is very similar to the tit-for-tat strategy that we see in evolutionary biology. But his idea of aesthetics came down to you have to treat art as an end unto itself, all right? It's something which is not helpful for you. In fact, if it was helpful, it wouldn't really be art. So, you know, it's a little bit complicated if you get to, you know, a bit architecture, right? You do use a building, it's useful, but it can also be very pretty. But he sort of noticed, well, the things that make it pretty tend to be like the crenellations, the columns, all that. That makes it, those things are not actually very useful, but they're gorgeous. And they're able to be gorgeous partly because when you look at them, you don't think, oh, well, good job, that column is keeping the ceiling up. You get to just think, oh, no, it's really nice. The artist could let their mind, you know, be creative with it, all right? They weren't super constrained. But this is very compatible with modern evolutionary biology. So, again, why does the blue mannequin bird work so hard on the dances that it does, right? The answer is, the more time that you spend practicing your dancing, the better that proves that you are so good at finding food that you can waste your time on something, right? It's, if you're interested in this, you've got to read your Amos Zahavi, you've got to read your Robin Hanson. This is the 90s, this is the noughties. Most people haven't heard of this, but it is true. Don't ask whether I'm cynical. Ask whether I'm correct. If I'm not correct, tell me why.
Okay, Hamish, can I ask you something just following up on that?
Yes.
Is there scope in your view of this art that is, you know, that animals also participate in? Mm-hmm. What is the role of suffering? Because it seems to me a lot of what we've heard about is how artists, when creating it, can be uncomfortable and it can relate to how they suffer. And also sometimes we as the people receiving the art, we don't like it. It makes us uncomfortable, but we do it anyway. Mm. And on top of that, it's been claimed that no non-human animal knows it's going to die, that we are unique in knowing that and have to live with that and express it in our art. How do these things fit into your picture?
Well, not all art is about suffering and death. So, okay. You know, okay, I can't bring to mind any animals that do art that's about suffering and death, I must admit.
Okay.
But they do practically all the other things that we do, which is a lot of stuff.
I'll bring you in, JJ, and then Vivek, and then we'll go out again.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I'm not interested in animals and what they do. If they have their own critics to work on whatever it is that they find pleasurable, or if it is a form of activity which reveals to them their own mortality, that's up to them. If they can sell tickets for it, even better for them. Again, it's outside of my remit, as it were.
I can tell.
Well, I mean, I think the interesting point, Hamish, is that you talk about AI as if they are an agency, and you talk about animals as if they're an agency, which suggests to me a kind of post-human or outside of the human frame of reference, which doesn't interest me, because really what we're talking about is the interplay between humans and their product. I mean, Kant does not talk very much about actual artworks. Hegel does quite a lot. He talks a lot about paintings. I think that's really the issue for me, that we are interested in the things we make for what it does for us, right? And that requires a degree of activity, of novelty, and making what has not already been made. And it also requires a level of activity on the side of us as a community of people who experience, right? I think that the one point about the artwork, suffering. I'm slightly annoyed about this discussion about suffering. I know that Nick Cave says that the AI didn't suffer, and I like Nick Cave's work very much. But the important thing about Nick Cave is he actually really works at it. He really, really, and almost it becomes fetishistic in his kind of self mythologization that he works at the labor of creating art. And it reminds me that I couldn't care less about artists, actually. I'm only interested as a critic in the artwork and what it does to me. I could not care one atom about whether the artist suffered or not. It's of no interest to me. The point being that we can talk about, you know, artists who explore this and that. I mean, you get that a lot in art student statements. And yes, okay, you may be exploring death, mortality, gender, post-colonial politics, I don't know, whatever it is, but if it's not a good artwork that does all that, it's not a good artwork. For me as a critic, being on the side of the public in this sense, articulator of something which is to do with the public's divided understanding of what itself understands, I'm on the side of the public in as much as the public looks to the artwork as the thing in question. I think these are important points when it comes to control. This is coming up a lot. You know, people are scared of all this, not because it's AI, but because it's another turn of the wheel of commodity culture, which is all about powerlessness and about the turning of human community and its cultural artifacts into a commerce in which the consumer is only that, a consumer.
I just want to push back on that. I think the cultural context and the historical context to a piece of work is what defines the piece of work. How can you just sort of not take that into account in sort of the
appreciation? Oh, no, everybody, you know, if you want to become a better person, learn the history of all artworks, right? But then you also have to learn to remember to feel the experience of the work as it presents itself to you in the present. Right? One can be either naive or overread.
Right. Okay. I think, yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. No, so I think lots of different things, power and control, have sort of cropped up. Just quickly, so I completely agree. AI is a medium, again, a medium for exploration. It's not an artist. It can never have the sort of sentient feelings, experiences of an artist. Again, so going back to control and power, I think this is where the gentleman over there was pointing out about regulation and human involvement, which means regulation. We can't let this sort of get out of hand. There have been numerous studies, actually, that ChatGPT has... the process is called red teaming. Forgive me if I'm wrong. But red teaming shows that actually it's not that hard to sort of hack the algorithm to sort of create... I think it's instructions for creating chemical weapons. So that's how, you know, it can be a weapon in itself. I'd just like to say that everything that I've heard, which is completely AI generated, is trash. It's rubbish. Like I look at, you know, the Elon Musk photo, or I listen to something which OpenAI have created on Musenet or Jukebox, and I think it's actually not good at all. But the thing that worries me the most is that my music and other people's music, other people's art, is being fed into these AI models. It's being trained on without my consent, and yeah. that's what's the most worrying thing. It's an opt-out system. It's not an opt-in system. And I think we should probably discuss that at one point.
Yes. Okay. This is a big issue.
There's websites like I Have Been Trained, etc. Was your work used to train an AI? If so, should your permission have been sought? Can you undo it now, or is it like trying to unbake a cake? Big questions. Can we take the mic to the back? A gentleman who's been very patient in a blue shirt. Oh, you're finished now. Well, take a quick shot, and then I'll get everyone in. That's all right. Just do it quickly.
The gentleman in the aisle, he mentioned the fear that you could reach a point when you'd never need a prompt, because it's quite a convincing argument that a prompt is an inherently creative and therefore artistic act. Yes, and I take solace in the idea that actually you could never not have some form of prompt. You said you could just give it no prompt and then chuck it the best paintings to work with, and it would work it out. But I would say the fact that in your selection of what the best paintings were, you're making a creative choice. So It's inextricably linked to the genesis of the piece.
Okay.
Quickly.
Make it very quick.
Very quick. There's the Buddhist sand sculpture that these guys make over the course of a year out of bits of sand. It's well known. And at the end, they destroy it. Because this conversation has happened in terms of product. In that, I'd say it's profoundly artistic. There is no end product. It's in the act of creation that it counts.
Okay, so can we now come to the cluster in the front? I'll take them, then I'll go back to this row. But let's try and make it very quick, I'll fit you all in. So just take everyone in this cluster, just pass the mic to each other.
Just very quickly,
can you stand up and use the mic?
Okay. Hamish, you lost me a bit. Crikey. I thought at one point you were developing a sort of philosophical anthropology, right? When you started talking about hierarchies and about the kind of the importance of art as a way of ordering those hierarchies. And then I kept thinking, actually, that sounds as if JJ's still going to be in a job in the future, right? And so when JJ made reference to Kant, I was thinking about Bourdieu's work around the idea that, of course, Kant presents the idea of the possibility of disinterestedness as a way of kind of as understanding aesthetics. And Bourdieu, Pierre Bourdieu, the much missed French sociologist, flips that and says, actually, it's all about interestedness, right? And so kind of one version of the future is that the kind of there will be a very talented elite that will all, as there always has been, that will be able to discursively construct creative practice as meaningful. And that will in itself be valid. And so the question then becomes, what will happen to the rest? I think the rest will be doing lots of interesting things in their homes with AI. But it won't be defined as art.
Can you pass it straight in front of you, actually? All right, and then do it in front, fine. As long as you all get in. Yep, go on.
Hi, I loved your comments on the performing arts. I spent 20 years as a musician. I now work in AI training musicians. However, I think there's a really important thing we're forgetting, particularly when in the performing arts, which is that an AI performance, we're thinking of it as something which is done to the audience. Whereas performance is a two-way thing. And we're just discovering in the latest research that was published last month, an audience breathes with the performers. And that is something which I cannot conceive how an AI on stage can get that sort of interactivity at that level with an audience. Perhaps you disagree.
Okay, can you pass it over, and then I'll come to this gentleman. Yep.
Thank you very much, it's been brilliant. Vivek, you obviously haven't seen Pope Benedict in a Balenciaga jacket, because that is a cracking piece of AI-generated art.
It's absolutely not, I'm sorry.
It's amazing, definitely. I suppose I really liked as well the point about AI as a medium, and I suppose I wanted to just say one more positive thing, I think, that comes out of conversations like this. I think using AI as a kind of mirror is a really useful device, because essentially what we're talking about here is like, what is art, right? That we're talking about, could AI end art? But essentially we're sort of talking about what is art. And, you know, I would, at sort of the Battle of Ideas, we're all interested in that. People would come to a session called What is Art? If I said that anecdotally, at least to some of my friends, what is art? They would tell me to stop being such a pretentious twat. So I think what AI is really positive for, if I said to the same people, do you think AI could ever make art? It sort of allows them to have that conversation. In a way, it feels like it's democratizing a conversation that for many, many years felt like it was quite closed off.
Okay, could you pass to this gentleman, please?
Hello, yeah. I had a question in response to the final point on the panel on ethics. So should artists have the right to be forgotten digitally completely, or opt out There's a lot on regulation at the moment. That could be a possibility. Opt out of being included either in a diffusion model or a large language model, or have just not have their prompts register in order to protect their integrity and perhaps, you know, the emotion that goes into their work, and stop their styles perhaps being perpetuated, and actually protect some innovation of styles.
Okay, can we bring the microphone over this side now and start in the front row? And then move backwards. We'll try and squeeze a few people in when we're getting near the end, so make it quick.
It was something to do with embodiment. I wanted to come back to that. And the kind of, so I liked what you said about the breathing. And it makes me think of when I've seen your dance piece, Rosie, with the soldiers. It was profoundly painful and beautiful. And there's something as well around this, you know, the whole gender stuff, which is around kind of meat Lego and something being outside of you, and that somehow you can make something that's not real, and there's something like there's no meaning. Things can be concrete, but there's no real connection. So I've got sort of questions. I'm a bit out of my depth with all of this, but it was, you know, it was, and it was the commodification of the body and the commodification of experience. So there's something around that.
Okay, there were a couple more, I believe. If we could just take them, and then we'll have to wrap up. Two more points. The lady here in the purplish jacket, yep, and then the gentleman behind.
One very quick point. Animals can be beautiful and they can do beautiful things, but they can't be artists because they cannot imagine what they want to create before they create it. And I think that's a really significant difference between animals and human beings in terms of art. I think the other quick point I want to make is that art history is in part a history of new forms. And new forms arrive and survive because they say something, they enable the artist to say something new about the human condition. So AI will survive, but only if it provides a new way of saying something about the human condition, not because it's a new lovely tool or anything like that.
Okay, and behind you, and that might have to be the last contribution, I'm afraid. If you could stand up, please.
All right, yeah, thank you. What I noticed is that when one deals with this sort of discussion, one sees, like, well, I particularly saw that there seems to be a bit of sentimentality. I mean, obviously, that's not a bad thing necessarily, but there's a bit of sentimentality with the way that people talk about, you know, aesthetics and artistic production. Because unless you have some sort of extra metaphysical or religious commitments, you have to admit that at the end of the day, like, the creative process is a neurobiological one that is amenable to, like, a neurobiological description under the physical sciences and under cognitive science especially. And that when one deals with AI has actually been used to understand different aspects of how the mind works. You know, you have artificial neural networks that, like, allow us to go back and actually understand how real neurons in the brain work. And unless you believe that there is some sort of, like, irreducible sort of soul that is completely unphysical, then one has to ultimately expect that
some of us do.
But I'm not saying, but just, like, but if you do, then you have to accept to a certain extent that even the most profound subjective experiences, whether of mortality, whether of disease, that they do come from some sort of neurobiological substrate and that they can be understood and explicated in that context. And so I was just sort of wondering, like, and obviously, yes, people might have that commitment, but I just wonder, like, why is it kind of, like, hidden when people debate sort of, like, whether or not artistic production will be sort of replaced or altered significantly by AI? Because, I mean, there's nothing wrong in my eyes with having that commitment. I have those commitments myself. But I feel like if you're going to have them, then you need to sort of, like, be honest with where you're coming from the debate from, rather than, I don't want to say pretending, like, sort of disguising one's prior commitments as having a completely unbiased view.
Okay. I'm going to let the speakers sum up. I'm going to do things backwards, though, because in previous debates, when I've done the announcements, everyone's buggered off. So I'm going to do the announcements now and then let the speakers sum up. Right. So there's going to be more debates about AI. There's going to be one tomorrow on ChatGPT and cheating and education. That's at 11 a.m. There's going to be one in a month's time in Buxton in the East Midlands at the Battle of Ideas. Buxton, I think Rob Bashforth here is speaking at that. That's going to be great. Please come, it's a lovely part of the country. There's this pamphlet on AI that I've written, but it's part of a huge series of pamphlets called Letters on Liberty. They're selling them in the bookshop just outside on the first floor, not far from here. And if it's too late to do it tonight and you're coming back tomorrow, have a look tomorrow and get some. And then after this, we're all going for a drink. We're going to 55 Broadway, which is a 5 to 10 minute walk away, and it's above a tube station. I've forgotten which one. St. James's tube station. So please join us all for a drink there. Right. Let's get our neurobiological substrates back on the issue of AI. And in the reverse order to the order you spoke in initially, if you could please offer us a concluding thought, beginning with you, Hamish.
Right, now I'll say something controversial. So in a manner of speaking, which is of practical importance, ChatGPT has suffered, I claim. If you had Alice and Bob, and let's say that Alice has suffered some traumatic thing that Bob has not suffered, and you did a bit of brain surgery on them, took out the piece of Alice's brain that remembered the specifics of that suffering and swapped it with the equivalent, well, not the equivalent, a part of Bob's brain, you swap them around, they wake up. Bob now has the memory of Alice. And so would you say that Bob suffered? It's a philosophical question. Don't need to think too hard about it, especially because you might say, well, no one's ever going to do that surgery. Seems pretty unlikely. Except that modern AI researchers kind of are doing that surgery. If you ask, you can get ChatGPT to try to remember things and think about specific things, and it does a pretty good job of conveying some of the emotions that a human would convey if they were describing the same thing, if they were answering the same question. I'm sure we've all had the experience of seeing some bit of art and thinking, God, yeah, this artist really captured what it means to suffer in this way. So to be clear, I'm not emotionally dead or something. I experienced that as well. But another experience I've had is of looking at that and then looking the artist up on Wikipedia and finding out, oh, that guy was actually fine. Artists are pretty good at deceiving you, just like humans are. That's how empathy works. And, you know, it might surprise some of you to hear that I don't believe in an extra-physical soul. I don't believe, and I think that explanations of anything based on qualia are ridiculous. Or consciousness. None of it means anything. It's not useful in answering questions that are of relevance to AI researchers and engineers. And those are the people that we're debating right now. And if we want to say anything that's of any use to them, we've got to be a bit more scientific, I'm afraid. I guess I'll leave it there.
Okay, Rosie.
Well, I had a year at University of Oxford as the artist in residence to the School of Anthropology, and I really did think that we debunked all the crap about dance being related to sex and courtship. Please. Okay. That we use the body in the metaphor of the art of the arts related to technologies through every era. So the body's been compared to a steam train. There's been a lot about the body as a computer or the humans as computers, and now we're doing it the same with AI and algorithms. It's a way for us to help to understand ourselves. It's the other way round. Briefly, I'm just going to talk very quickly. I have done quite a lot of work with dance and neuroscientists, and it's still really, there's not a lot of research out there. We still really don't understand very much about how humans watch dance and what it does to them. But what we do know is that if you do exactly the same piece of dance to Mozart or to just breath, we have completely different reactions to the dance. When the dance is done to, sorry, it was a piece of Bach, it fires off areas of the brains that are related to mathematic, sort of in enjoyment of mathematics and pattern recognition. When we do exactly the same piece of dance, but just using the breath, some of the audiences, we did it with audience research, and we also put people through fMRI scanners. The audiences and the fMRI scanners, they both sort of came up with the same results, which was that the dance with breath, people loved it because it made them feel connected to the humans. It felt raw and it felt embodied, and they could feel the effort the dancers were making. The people that hated it for the same reason. So whenever I'm choreographing, I know that your brains are working in completely different ways, and that's the skill of the artist, to make sure that the message is being put across in different ways, that every single human in that room is watching that dance and feeling that dance in a slightly different and private way. So I loved your comment about embodiment there. Thank you.
Okay. Vivek.
Well, I think AI really is nothing more than a tool. It's here to help us as artists in the creative process. It's not here to replace us, and it'd be really naive and dangerous of us to want any more of this piece of technology. It's the human experience within a piece of music which makes it so tangible and so special. And unfortunately, this is something which AI can never, ever replicate. On the point about AI and the ethics behind it, I think there needs to be a greater conversation between artists, the tech companies, and government, i.e. the legislators and the regulators. So we need three things. The first is consent. Can I opt out of having my music or my art being fed into this algorithm? It's education, educating people and students and kids about what this technology might mean for them going forwards. And transparency. You know, OpenAI hasn't actually been very transparent about what data is being fed into its DALL-E 2 models. Still haven't released it.
Great. And finally, JJ.
Okay. I mean, I think prompts are, and prompt makers or prompt artists, that's a real thing, because it is about intervening in a technology to manipulate it towards your own ends, just like film editors didn't exist, right? Prompt editors have not existed up until now. Film editors didn't exist until film came along and people started going, well, what can we do with this thing? So I think it's important to be open to makers and also audiences who are excited by new things that will, as I think Gregor said, it makes a good point, make meaning, which is up to us, really. So I think the point about, you know, there's nothing creative made in the 21st century, the Jason Farrago piece, is a very cynical piece again. It's more that we've given up on trying to think what is meaning and meaningful in culture, and that we should start to have another crack at that, because it's becoming very boring and it's become very circular. I think, neurophysiology and neuroaesthetics, it always baffles me. It's like, you know, it's as if people just discovered that we were made of atoms, you know. The fact that bark fires certain kind of zones in my brain, well, okay, but in reality, put a scanner on my brain and watch me look at Duchamp's fountain and see what happens, right? Your scanner will show that I'm thinking, right? And also that I'll be enjoying that. So I find that we need to get back to the question of who's in control of this thing. I think it's a really important point that Gent made over here. He was there a moment ago, about people will be making things with AI in their homes. I think that's very sad. It's also very sad if there's some kind of ultra cultural elite, like some kind of weird Marie Antoinette-ish, you know, French aristocracy, you know, French monarchy kind of elite doing stuff in their kind of palaces with physical people. I think the greatest revolution in culture has been bringing the masses in to deliberate what it is that art and culture are for and who it's for since the middle of the 19th century. I also think one of the greatest eruptions of creativity are post-war, when working class people took technology, electric guitars, drums, recording studios, and exploded. Produced one of the most kind of the greatest sort of flowerings of mass human culture that we have ever seen. So we do need to think about what tools are for, but who's in control? I think the problem we have right now in the end about AI and art is that we have great misgivings about who's in control of this. That's all, and that we really should stop thinking about regulating things, and we should start demanding that we have greater claim and access to the tools.
Great. Let's go have a drink. Can we thank our speakers?